From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Sunday morning when a woman in Rochester decided to share her thoughts about institutional racism. She chose Twitter, and it's safe to say that Miriam Zinter had no idea what she was getting into. Now, Zinter has appeared on this program before discussing various activist causes, local housing policy. She thought that maybe her Twitter thread would reach a few people. She was not thinking nearly big enough, as it turns out. Miriam wrote, quote, "This is a thread about how institutional racism works. In the 1950s, SUNY schools and community colleges offered free tuition to local students. My mother-in-law, who is white, took advantage of this program and received her degree from SUNY Buffalo in speech therapy. When my father graduated from high school, he was not told of the opportunity for free tuition because black students were routinely not informed of the opportunity for a free college education." End quote, and the thread goes on from there, telling the story of her dad, a man with all kinds of technical expertise and training, but a man who could only get a job with the Navy, scraping barnacles. Black men weren't considered for the kinds of jobs Miriam's father wanted and was qualified for. And in a moment, you're going to hear how that story progressed and turned out. Miriam's thread has gone viral, approaching, well, the last I saw like an hour ago, 25,000 retweets, 50,000 likes. She's had feedback from readers across the country. Prominent journalists like Soledad O'Brien have retweeted her thread, urging all of us to read it. And that has done so much more than Miriam thought it probably could on Sunday morning. So we asked her to come in today and share her dad's story and give us a sense of the tremendous feedback you've received when you were, what, getting ready to go to church and you thought you'd just do a little thread.
Yeah, I go to Our Lady of Lourdes in Brighton, and we were having Mass on the grass that day, and I had volunteered to help with Mass on the grass, do some setup and cleanup. And for some odd reason, I just felt like writing a Twitter thread about my dad. I'd been thinking about him for a while and what he went through with the Navy, what my parents went through with trying to buy their first house. And for some reason, the spirit moved me. I just sat down. My husband said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just writing a quick thread about institutional racism and my dad." And I finished it and he shut my iPad and said, "Okay, let's go to Mass on the grass," and left. And I had no idea. No idea that it would resonate with people.
I want to know how quickly it blew up and what was the reason? Was there one particular person who shared it, who had a huge following that blew it up for you, or what was it?
I have no idea. It almost seemed like at first I was wondering why, and I would checked people who retweeted it, and they had maybe 163, 200 followers, not a lot of followers. It almost seemed just like, you know, when people give a dollar bill and everybody gives a dollar bill, and it just builds on itself like snow, like a snowball. And it was surprising to me. It was just surprising to me. But the most surprising thing to me is, unfortunately, a lot of times when people post, I'll read a lot of the comments, and there are negative comments and things that make me feel angry or sad. But with overwhelmingly, the comments have been positive. There have been thousands and thousands of comments, and I've tried to wake up early and go online so I can at least acknowledge people that took the time to read it and share it and share their experiences with me. If they took the time to do that, I would like to be polite and, you know, thank them. I can't keep up. So, but it's really been, I am very grateful and I am very humbled.
Surprised, I imagine.
I am overwhelmed. I never expected this.
Now, I'm looking at some of your other tweets because now all of these folks are finding you and they're going, "Well, what else is she writing about?" You've got a lot of interest now, Miriam, so a lot of pressure. By the way, if you want to follow Miriam on Twitter, she's MimZway, MimZway. And I think it's fair to point out here that the reason this Twitter thread, which we're about to go through, and the story of institutional racism and the remarkable story of her father, I think the reason it went viral is because the story is so important. The thread is so valuable. And it was one of those rare cases of virality just because of quality. Whereas the tweet that I authored that got the most feedback only happened that way because Laura Ingraham retweeted it. I don't even really remember exactly what I wrote or how it ended up on Laura Ingraham's radar. But when someone with a million followers retweets you, you get a lot. And they were not all of the kinds of comments that you're getting. I will say that. But no, yours, though Soledad O'Brien's a pretty big name. She retweeted you. And that was pretty amazing.
I love Soledad O'Brien. I am in awe.
What was it like for you when you saw that retweet?
I hadn't heard of it, but a friend of mine said, did you know Soledad O'Brien retweeted you? And I got a couple of women who are friends of mine who sent me notifications, Soledad O'Brien. And she put me on her Instagram. And boy, you know, I'm such a fan. And it almost brought tears to my eyes. When I think about it, I do get overwhelmed and emotional.
Now, you wanted to write this thread because as we talk about racism in this country, I often think of this conversation I had with a teacher a couple of years ago, a local high school teacher who's in a suburban district, who told me it's amazing how many of her students, her white students, think racism really doesn't exist anymore because they never hear the N-word. And that's pretty much the extent of what they've been taught racism is, as opposed to structure, as opposed to institutions, as opposed to what happens over time to families, to individuals who are looking for jobs. So I think there's such value in doing this. But what prompted this now? Was there a reason that, like, Sunday morning you're going, now's the time, I'm going to tell my dad's story?
Last year when my mom and dad and I, we were driving back from my sister's house in Rhode Island from Thanksgiving. We have to take two cars because we can't all fit in one car, and I don't like my mom and dad to drive that distance. And my mom fell asleep, and my dad and I just had some quiet time together, and he rarely talked about his experience in the Navy. I knew he had been in the Navy. I knew that different shipmates had reached out to him to do some types of get-togethers. He never wanted to do it, and I just didn't understand what happened. He wasn't in the Navy during wartime. He was in the Navy in 1956. So what happened? And for some odd reason, he opened up for the first time and told me about why he joined. He was always really good at fixing electronics, and he wanted a degree in electrical engineering, but he couldn't afford college. And a friend of his talked him into, said, my dad had considered the Air Force, but a friend said, no, the Navy's got a great program in electrical engineering. We should join together. And so they agreed, and my dad showed up at the recruitment office, and his friend wasn't there. So my dad was talked into it and was told that, yeah, he could join the electrical engineering group and learn all about electrical engineering and technology. So he signed up. And when he got on the ship, he was told, silly Negro, you can't be part of the engineering group. You have three choices. You can be a cook. You can swab the deck, be a custodian. I think from what I've learned, there was also a valet where you could basically butler to an officer, or you could scrape the barnacles and repaint the side of the ship. And so my dad took the barnacles. But he soon developed a reputation on the ship for being able to fix anything. So all the sailors would bring to him their broken electronics, and my dad could fix things. And he's always been really good at analytical thinking. And so from what he says, this story, that the radar went down on the ship and the group was there. They were trying everything. They were trying to figure it out. And finally, they were so frustrated and angry. It was going on day three. And one of the guys said, well, there's a Negro on board and he seems to be able to fix anything. Do you want me to get him? And the guy who was head of the electrical engineering program said, I don't care if he's purple, yellow, or pink. Go get somebody. And so they got my dad. And my dad said that when they put him, it was in a little room, he said. And he said it was like God directed his hand. He said he could never take credit for what happened, but for some reason his hands just ended up on a fuse, and it was this fuse that had screwed up the system. So he replaced the fuse, and the radar came back up. And when he came out of the room, the head of the engineering program said, "Why aren't you in my program?" And he said, "Well, I've been told Negroes aren't allowed in your program, sir." And that changed. And so my dad got to be in the program. He said it took him a lot longer. And when he got in, other people had been in for a while, but he was so happy to be in that program. And he ended up coming out of the Navy and really wanting to get a job in electricity as an electrical engineer. But at first, he could really only get a job as a janitor. And then, you know, he met my mom and married my mom, and they had me. And just like everybody, they wanted to have a house. And when they went to...
This was when, by the way?
This was... I was born in 1964. So I think about 2 years later, 1966, so after the Civil Rights Act, he went to the banks and said, "I'm a veteran. I'm interested in getting a VA loan, and we're interested in this house." And he was told, "Well, there's a deed restriction. We're sorry, but that house can't be sold to Negroes. We would love to give you a loan, but we can't because of that deed restriction." But every house had that deed restriction. And so any black person who went and wanted to get a bank loan couldn't, because there was deed language that prevented them from owning that property. So my dad found out about an opportunity in Alaska. He was mad, by the way, that I revealed that he did some work for the Navy there. So, but he went to Alaska for a year.
Well, the cat's out of the bag.
I know. It was like, what? So my mom and I moved in with his mother, my grandmother, and we shared a room. And my dad worked up in Alaska for a year. They provided room and board, and they paid a premium. He made $50,000 in 1966 for doing that. I think actually I was 18 months old. And he sent every penny home to my mom. She banked it. And when he came back, they found a builder to build them a house, because that house would have no deed restriction. And my father paid the builder, Mr. Oot, in Liverpool. It's now called The Meadows, but then it was called Oot Meadows. And Mr. Oot built my parents a house, and we moved in. And that year, 1968, I went to kindergarten in Liverpool, New York, and I was the first black student to go to Nate Perry Elementary School.
Amazing stuff. Did you get a sense, talking to your dad, that how did he react, as far as you know, to being told, because he goes to the Navy, thinking, "I can use my skills for this," and he was told that we don't put black people in those programs. You can clean barnacles. Did he tell you what that was like?
He didn't say in so many words. I was very quiet because it was the first time he was talking about it. One of the things he did say was that there was one naval officer who was incredibly racist and used to do horrible things to the black sailors. After the kitchen was cleaned, he would dump all the garbage on the floor, make them crawl through it, do awful things. But for him, you know, that one awful racist officer, there was also the guy who ran the engineering program, who did his best to make sure that my dad got all the knowledge that he needed. So, you know, you have two opposite ends of the spectrum. Somebody who's in a position of power, who uses that power to subjugate his fellow man, and somebody who's in a position of power who uses that power to elevate his fellow man. And so my dad had a lot of feelings about the Navy, good and bad, but that was the first and only time he ever shared it with me. And I thought about it, you know, and my mind would continuously go to what he went through and what he endured, and, you know, how he just happened to have this talent with electrical things, and how he got the reputation, and how he happened to be in that position. But it also makes me think of all of the people who don't necessarily have an electrical talent, or who don't happen to be called to be in the right place, or who don't have somebody who sees beyond their skin color and allows them to be the best person they can be.
I'm thinking also of the conversation we had last week about the dignity of work, and I don't want to carry on this conversation looking down on people who sweep barnacles or clean decks or anything like that. I mean, there is dignity and certainly value, and that work needs to be done. It's just a question of when you've got someone like Miriam's father who has skills and expertise, but is told you will not be allowed to get further education in that. You will not be allowed to work in that. That's pretty remarkable. And I wonder if he ever thought, or if you, have you thought about what would have happened to you and your family if the radar hadn't gone down that day?
Actually, I've thought about it more and more. And, you know, or he didn't find that job opportunity in Alaska, or they didn't find Mr. Oot, or he didn't have his mom who could take my mom and I in so we could save the money. I mean, so many things line up. It's like what they say, you know, the whisper of a butterfly wing that can send somebody on a completely different trajectory. And I think that when you think like that as a human being, whenever you see an opportunity where you can lift someone up, even if it's just a simple word of encouragement, even if it's just giving somebody the dollar when they ask you for it and not questioning why, any opportunity that we have as another human being to make a day, a minute, an hour easier for another person can have incredible repercussions, and we should all do that.
I see the phone ringing. Listeners, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking about understanding institutional racism. Miriam's Inter story has gone viral, pretty supernuclear viral, more than she thought possible, with tens of thousands of people reading and sharing the story. And you can call and share your thoughts, not only on her story, but if you want to talk institutional racism, how do we teach it? How do we not teach it? How do we make sure that we are teaching it in a way that our kids understand it? 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Miriam, if we had an educational system that was telling the story of what happened to your father, and I'm obviously talking in the general now, but just helping all of us understand what black men like your father went through, you wouldn't have to jump on Twitter on a Sunday morning before church to just do your part to help educate. Are you disappointed in the educational system? Have you seen any change? What do you want to see happen there?
I can't really speak to the educational system. My kids went through school. I went through school. It seems like we need to learn a whole lot more. Every year there's something new to learn with technology, and some things have to be cut out. A friend of mine is a principal in the Gananda School District, and we were speaking last evening about what's taught with the civil rights movement and, you know, how they're teaching it there in their system. And she felt very comfortable that that institutional racism, civil rights, all of those things were being taught. But I think sometimes putting a very human face on it and saying, you know, this isn't just what happened to one person. This happened to an entire large group of people, and it has repercussions. And, you know, just the whole system of redlining entire communities of, you know, black people and saying, we are going to suck all investment and capital out of this community and bleed it to death. And then white people will go through a neighborhood and lock their doors and say, why is it that this neighborhood looks so bad? You know, that these roofs are falling apart, that the homes are deteriorating, that things are boarded up. Well, that was systematic. That was not allowing home equity loans, not allowing business loans, not allowing home buying loans. No capital went into the community. And slowly but surely, you lost retail, you lost bank branches, you lost owner occupants, you lost all of those things with nothing to keep that community up. And then we had the Community Reinvestment Act, which said we have to put money back in those communities. And it was a great thing. But then when the real estate market went belly up because of greed and mismanagement and deception from wealthy people who got blamed on right-wing radio. Rush Limbaugh saying, oh, well, it's because the Community Reinvestment Act. Loans were given to poor people, and poor people did this. Blaming poor people for wanting a loan and wanting something when the bank actually sold them a loan at a much higher interest rate with high fees that they knew people would not be able to keep up with. And when you look at generations and generations of divestment in communities, not just individuals, but entire communities, that institutional, systematic, and purposeful racism has consequences down the road. And not just for Black people, it had consequences for white people as well, and consequences well into the future for folks. And we need to know what it looks like, because it comes back in different forms. And we need to say never again. And we need to stand up when we see people being treated differently because of their skin color, because of their religion, because of their sexual orientation, because we're all on this planet together. We're all people. We are all just trying to live a righteous life and be the best person we can be.
Class is in session with Miriam Zinter, who's not just a woman of color, but someone who's worked in housing, understanding policy. I mean, your professional qualifications offer you a great deal of background on this, too. Fair?
That's correct. Maybe that's why I wrote it. I have no idea what hit me.
If I were a local teacher, and I noticed this thread and I heard you here, I'd have you in front of my class real quick, because you're right. Every year there's more to learn, and teachers have tough decisions to make about what do we include, what do we not include. But I really regret growing up in a mostly white district that never even mentioned the word redlining. Your father's story, your family's story, and the way you tell it is really, really powerful. We've got a lot more to share with Miriam coming up here. Let's grab a couple of phone calls. This is Calvin first on the phone. Go ahead, Calvin.
Hi, Evan. Hi, Miriam.
Hey, Calvin.
I'm so happy that you're on Connections and sharing your story. It's just so indicative of the stories of my family and so many other families of Black individuals and people of color. And it's so important that we keep having these conversations now, because, like Evan mentioned a little earlier, there's this myth still in 2018 that somehow we're in a post-racial society, that if individuals just kind of pull themselves by their bootstraps, that somehow we can forget the thousands of years of history that have put the United States where we are. And if individuals just work really hard and do their best and stop complaining that, you know, they can have a better life for themselves, completely ignoring the history that this country was founded on, that laws were passed and institutions purposefully and methodically kept individuals of color from the conversation, from buying homes, from having generational wealth. And, you know, I see it in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood. I see it in the conversations and the classes that we have at 540 West Main. I see it in my own work and the struggle of having a nonprofit and being a leader that's of color and not having access to the same opportunities and programs and not even knowing, very much like your father. So often we have this concept of meritocracy in the United States and even in Rochester, where everyone is an individual and we all get to where we get to based on our individual talents, not understanding that there are subsidies and programs and monies that are given to people who do not look like me, and they get access to certain things that people of color don't even have, not only not have access to, but don't even know about. And even when you know about it, you're disparaged against reaching it or accessing it. So I'm just happy to hear you and to continue this conversation.
Calvin, you're the best. And if you are not familiar with 540 West Main, Calvin hosts all kinds of workshops for the community, sessions. He's an amazing person and such a great resource in the Susan B. Anthony neighborhood. If you're listening to me and you feel moved, contact Calvin at 540 West Main Street and help them out there. They are doing great things for that community.
Calvin, thank you. Thanks for calling. I know we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Evan. Bye.
All right, thanks. That's Calvin calling from Rochester. Let's get Rich next in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, Evan. This is such a good show. I've listened to many of your shows, and I've heard you've had some very successful white people on your show who took offense to the fact that they felt that they had no advantage and they worked really hard. And some of them were very, very, very successful. And they don't realize that you can work as hard as you want, but when you go to the bank and the bank tells you no, or you go to a meeting and they see your black face and they tell you no because they see your black face, or any time that you have any business in Rochester, I look around the city of Rochester all the time. I can't say, okay, maybe I don't know all of them, but I don't know of any significant black businesses that get capital investment from the banks in this town. I see a lot of barbershops. I see a lot of everything like that. But I don't see any wealth-creating businesses run by blacks in this town. I see the banks pulling out of neighborhoods. I see Wegmans pulling out of the inner city. And here's a company that makes, we don't know how many untold millions because they're a private company, yet they refuse to keep one store open in the inner city. I see this constantly. I see when a black person who has that's a contractor goes out and he can't charge what a white contractor charges. As soon as he does that, he gets no business. So he's charging 70%, 60%. And white people will talk about how great he is. But if that man charged the equivalent price of the white contractor, they wouldn't come to it. I see this constantly. So when people tell me about the N-word, and oh my God, someone said the N-word, I really don't care. I don't want to hear the teachable moments because someone had a conversation about someone saying an N-word. Because meanwhile, we're talking about the N-word, and yet still in the banks, they're turning down black people for loans. And they're turning down black people for lines of credit to keep their business running at a stable level. I see it all over this town. The racism is so deep and endemic in this town. And all we have people tell you is that you just work hard and you pull yourself by your bootstraps, and then you reach down and there's no boot or strap down there to pull up.
Rich, so, thank you. Yeah, powerful stuff as always, Rich. Thank you. Miriam, you want to add to that?
Rich, thank you so much for bringing that up, especially investment of capital in minority businesses. That is correct. And then also, I really appreciated your point about very wealthy people who are under the impression that they did it all by themselves. And I spoke with someone who is an incredibly wealthy individual who had received a free SUNY education and had credit cards, access to credit cards to start their business. And this was in the 50s. And you may recall minorities and women were not allowed to have credit cards in the 1950s. And so it was so infuriating to me that this individual could not see that, no, you started on third base. You had access to credit. You had access to an unsecured loan from friends who worked at a bank, and you had a free college education. Those were all things that landed you on third base ahead of women and minorities. And yes, you built a great business. You should be proud of that. Nobody should not be proud of something great that they've done. But don't think that anybody could do it, and don't think you did it on your own. Give thanks and gratitude where thanks and gratitude is due.
And maybe if you have that realization, like a guy like me, I can see all kinds of advantage I've had. Be open to a world that offers those same opportunities to everyone, truly. Instead, a lot of people feel like it's sort of a zero-sum game, and I think there's this urge to protect. Power protects power. Let me grab another phone call. This is down in Silver Lake. This is Sandra next. Go ahead, Sandra.
Hello there. I try to listen to your show every day because I learn so much when I listen.
You.
And I just want to say this was such an inspirational story. And because of the tweeting that went viral, I think this would make an amazing movie. It'd be a wonderful movie that would be so inspirational to so many because that time period was not that long ago. I think of myself in that time period, I had no awareness of everything that was going on. And I just think this would be an incredible movie. And I hope that's what happens with this story.
Well, Sandra, thank you. Unfortunately, if it sounds like an incredible movie to you, what happened to Miriam's father, it's pretty common.
Yes.
It's pretty common, though. I mean, this is the movie that would be extraordinary to a lot of people, but it's not all that extraordinary if you're black in America. You know what I mean?
I know, but it would show what has happened. It would show just so many people are so unaware of the institutional racism.
Yeah.
That this would, you know, it would bring it out and show it that, wow. And I know it's not that, but like I said, I grew up in a rural community, mm-hmm. very sheltered, and wow, this is just an incredible story. I just think it's a wonderful story.
Sandra, thank you for your kind words.
Yeah, Sandra, thank you. Thanks for listening. And Miriam, you want to add to some of that?
I just thank you so much. I think that, you know, we all live in silos, and people were more segregated sometimes than ever. And in the black community, we all just understood that this happened to our dads, our grandfathers, our neighbors, our uncles, our nephews, our nieces. But in the white community, unless you were doing this, you know, you're concerned with your family and the people you know. We know what we know. And we all are limited by our own experiences. And I think social media is a really great tool to start to break down those barriers and the walls. And then in just a plain and simple way, say, you know what? This happened to me, or this happened to my family, and I would like to share it with you. And I really appreciate your kind words and you taking the time to call in today, Sandra.
Yeah, there's something really generous about your response there, Miriam, because when you post a thread, like, and by the way, our guest, Miriam Zinter, posted a Twitter thread on Sunday that has gone international viral with tens of thousands of retweets and interests. And I mean, you've really heard from people kind of everywhere, haven't you? Thousands of comments on this thread. Amazing.
Absolutely.
Stuff. Yeah. So when you do that and black people read it and go, yep, and white people read it and go, what? You know, that tells you the divide. But Miriam, your spirit of responding to Sandra, who says, I lived in a rural community, I had no idea. Or when I say, look, I went to a mostly white suburban high school, we never mentioned redlining, I had no idea until I was, I don't know, 30 years old or something. You're not shaming me. You're not shaming Sandra for that. And that to me is kind of instructive as you look to build bridges, because, you know, you certainly could. I'd probably deserve it a little bit. I mean, I don't know if I did, but maybe, I'm just curious to know how you feel when you hear from Sandra, or when I tell you my story of not growing up with any clue that this had happened, and why you don't feel the urge to sort of push back hard, shame, et cetera.
I think you meet everybody where they are. I think that's really important. You meet people where they are. And I know some people say, I should not have to be your instructor. I should not have to be your teacher. But I think we all should be our brother's teacher. And I think that when you come at people with understanding and grace and love, I think that's really an important aspect. And maybe it's because I'm Catholic. I don't know. Maybe it's because my parents were really involved in the civil rights movement. They marched on Washington. We've always been taught that you meet people where they are, and you try to give everybody respect. There are some people who I have met who were very hard to love, and some people where it was very hard to give them respect. But people only know what they know. And if I can be a teacher, or I can be an example, that's what I want to be. And sometimes people will say, oh, well, why doesn't your father hate white people, or your mother? Why don't you? And when you accept hate and embrace that into your heart, you become the hater.
Read Miriam's thread. Definitely should read it. And it's a good opportunity for you not only to read it, but to share it with others. It's a thread about institutional racism that impacted her father, her father's career, her family, where they lived, where they were allowed to live. It's a remarkable thread, and it's a great example. We all dog Twitter, but Twitter can still connect and elucidate, and it's a really powerful thing. Let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back to your phone calls. Miriam mentioned, by the way, if you read her thread, that she is going to write in the future about how difficult it was for your father to get a job using his engineering skills, and how when he finally did get the job, there were other obstacles. And if you, is it okay if I ask you about those things?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So let's do that. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back and we'll talk about that and get more of your phone calls on this remarkable story coming up here on Connections. I'll tell you what's coming up on Thursday on our next Connections. In our first hour, a conversation about standardized school testing. Daniel Koretz is the author of The Testing Charade, Pretending to Make Schools Better. He'll join us to discuss why he thinks standardized testing has negative impacts on student learning. In our second hour, we talk workforce development in Rochester and the Finger Lakes. A local program has been highlighted by a statewide nonprofit. We're going to talk Green Visions and Greentopia Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I mentioned off the top of the program the only part of the story that Miriam let me tell because I did it in the intro, but part of the story that I'd like to just make one more sort of touch on one more time here is the fact that in the 1950s, as you write in your Twitter thread, SUNY schools and community colleges offered free tuition to local students. So your mother-in-law, who's white, took advantage and received a degree from SUNY Buffalo in speech therapy. Your father graduated high school. Could he have pursued that had he known?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If he was aware that low income, I think you had to be low income. If you were a low income person, and I don't think you even had to have a super high average. I think if you had a B or better average, that you could qualify for free SUNY tuition. Now, that didn't include room and board. My mother-in-law lived home and she worked at the same time and she worked hard. And I don't take that from her at all. She used that speech therapy degree to help thousands of children with speech impediments, and it was a wonderful thing. But then I think about all of the other people that could have used it and benefited, and how we've lost as a society because people didn't know. And I'm not sure how systematic it was. I'm not sure if there were limited spaces, and so it was told to guidance counselors, well, you know, only make sure that you let the kids know who can truly benefit from this, wink, wink, nod, nod. You know, don't waste a placement. I'm not sure how it worked out.
But your dad didn't know.
But my dad did not know.
And he was one among many black men, black people who did not know about this availability.
Correct.
Okay. And then when you think about the conversations we have in our community, when people push back and they say, yeah, well, I may be white, but I worked for everything I got. I didn't get any help. Is that hard for you to hear that?
You know what? It's not hard. It's not unexpected. I think sometimes people are afraid to admit that they have help, or don't even realize that something that they received was help. Nobody comes into this planet on their own and learns and thrives. We all have help, whether that came from having a secure home, which I did. My mom and dad were there. I always had food on the table. I always had clean clothes to wear. That's an advantage. Or whether or not you got a free tuition, or whether or not you had friends who worked at a bank who gave you an unsecured loan. Yeah, you worked hard and you paid it back, but that was help. So when people like to think that they're self-made, I understand that in America, there's a certain sense of pride in that. But there is no shame in being grateful for others to help us on our way and to turn around and do that for someone else. And sometimes I think the problem with people saying that they're self-made is that they feel that they have no obligation to help their fellow man. And that's wrong. We all have that obligation.
Let me get Richard in Greece on the phone next. Go ahead, Richard.
Hi, Evan. I've been listening to your caller, and I thought I would add a different layer to it to help people understand prejudice.
Okay.
Basically, how this is working is I'm going through counseling. I married a white woman, found out that her ex-husband was very prejudiced, and him and his brothers would say that have things gotten so bad that this is how far you've fallen? So I stayed. 25 years later, I dealt with a lot of anger that I stayed, and we're going through counseling and it looks like subsequent divorce. And now I've realized that I love her, but the fact is, the reality is I stayed only because these guys told me I wasn't good enough and I wasn't going to give them that satisfaction.
Oof. Wow.
So it's kind of a difficult thing now is I'm also a combat veteran. So during the VA counseling, it came up that I was very angry with her because of these guys who pretty much I gave them power to take over my life. And now as I'm kind of fighting to keep the woman I love now, the fact is that I stayed with her was only because of these guys. And that's kind of where I am right now. And I'm just trying to move on and grow. I just wanted your callers to hear that, to get a different perspective on bigotry.
Stay there for a second, Richard. I'm so sorry to hear that you're going through that. Miriam, anything you want to add to Richard?
Richard, when people think less of you for your skin color, something that has nothing to do with who you are in your heart and who you are as a person, that's on them. It's not on you. And I hope that now that you're kind of coming to grips with counseling and realizing that you love your wife and hopefully she loves you back and you can love yourself, that you'll just get rid of all the negativity that her family brought into it. But that's really hard. And I appreciate you taking the time to call in today, and I wish you only the best.
Yeah, Richard, good luck to you. I'm so sorry. Are you hopeful at the very least going forward, as Miriam says, that you can find a way to, as much as is possible, let go of whatever hate or negativity they were bringing into your life?
Yeah, I think as time has moved on, but the weird thing is that when they first found out that it was my anger toward her, I almost felt a sense of freedom. Only about 6 months later did I realize I actually love this woman that I spent 25 years with. That started off in this, just, I mean, to help with Miriam, to help other people understand it, when you're Black, it seems like you have to prove all the time. And right now I'm just learning just to live. And I'm not going to worry about all these other people. I'm just going to live every day like they do and not have a group of people hoping you fail and to take that power back.
Richard, much love and respect for you and good luck to you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, guys. Keep having shows like this. This is great.
You got it. Thank you, Richard. Good luck. And think about what Richard is saying there. Constantly feeling like you have to prove yourself in different ways just for being Black. I cannot relate to that as a white man. I appreciate and try to absorb it as much as I can when I hear those stories. I just try to listen. And Richard, that'll stay with me. So good luck to you on that. Miriam, you've been on this program, I think it was after the Women's March in 2017 that you were on this program talking about activism and talking about the way people try to bring progress about. And there are different approaches. There are people who say, as you kind of briefly touched on earlier this hour, it's not my job to educate you. And you can feel some of that fire, which again, I mean, like I'm not begrudging anybody that kind of an emotion to it. But ultimately, do you find that counterproductive? How do you feel about the different approaches in the activism community?
That's a great question. I hate to say it is what it is. I can understand frustration and anger and always feeling like you have to explain yourself and getting just sick and tired of it, mm-hmm. just feeling so tired and not wanting to do it. We just approach things differently. I don't know if one's better than the other. I just know the way that I like to approach things.
You mentioned that you're going to be writing more using your Twitter handle, MimziWay, by the way, MimziWay, about your dad and the struggles that he had, not just, you know, everything that you've already mentioned, but he finally gets a job and you said the police would stop him each morning. What happened?
We had the house built in Liverpool, and if you know where the Meadows are, Electronics Parkway, which is GE, is very close. It's less than a mile. And so when my dad finally got a job at GE, he would take the car and drive from our neighborhood over to Electronics Parkway, but he did not look like he belonged. And so he was pulled over. And the policeman, you know, what are you doing here? Oh, I live here. You live here. A whole bunch of things. So you would think it would stop, but he would get pulled over in the morning. And he was worried that he was going to be late. So he ended up for a while bicycling and taking the bicycle through the back roads just to make sure that he arrived. And my dad, he's a very timely man. So he thinks if you're there on time, you're late. So it was a good thing that he always goes very early, because he was not late, even though he thought that the reason the policeman was stopping him was to make him late.
Jeopardize his job?
Yeah, that's what he thought. But he was never late. But when I grew up, I thought that everybody got stopped by the police at least once a week. I did not realize that was unusual to be pulled over by the police at least once a week. We would say, "Hey, how's it? Hi," you know, to the officer, and my father would say, "Okay, I'm pulling out my license and registration now, officer." And I thought that all people said that, announced when they were getting their license and registration. The first time I realized white people don't talk that way to a policeman was when I dated a white guy, and we were in his car, and he got pulled over, and he mouthed off to the policeman, and I had never in my life saw anything like that, because the experience was so different. But more so than the policeman, one of the things that I remember the most is when we moved into the house, and my mom had this kitchen with a sliding glass door, and she came down in the morning to make us breakfast, and she opened the curtains to the sliding glass door, and there was spray paint on the windows. And my mom looked at it, and then she went outside, and somebody had spray painted, "Go home." Can I say the N-word on here?
You can quote whatever you want.
"Go home, niggers," on the back of our house with spray paint across the sliding glass door. And my mom had taken me out, and we looked at it, and I was trying to sound it out, and my mom rushed me back in. And I just remember there were a lot of things that happened like that. People that would run up on our lawn, people that threw a brick through our window, people that would knock over our swing set. And I just remember my mom getting the soap in the water and going out and scrubbing the paint off of the sliding glass door, and my dad deciding that he was going to paint our house dark brown because nothing would show up. And they didn't call the police. What were the police going to do? But they just handled everything with a quiet dignity. And I never realized everything they went through until I was an adult and looked back on it. And I am so grateful for everything they taught me and all the adversity that they faced and how they faced that.
Amazing stories. Just amazing. Got to squeeze in about 30 seconds. This is Zoe on the phone next. Go ahead, Zoe.
Miriam, I just wanted to say, with everything you and your family have been through, I so appreciate your perspective about being able to teach and share instead of kind of accuse people that they should have already known what you've gone through. I think that you could have so much anger about this and you could really have that perspective, but I think that teaching and sharing creates so much more empathy, and it's so important today, and I just wanted to let you know that I really appreciate that perspective.
Thank you, Zoe.
Yeah, you've had comments like that by the thousands now. When's this going to die down?
I hope soon. I can't keep up with responding to people. No, thank goodness. You know, I don't really have notifications on my phone. So
okay. Well,
I did not tie my phone number to Twitter.
Oh.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Well, you're old school that way.
You know, and it's paying off.
I know you're going to have more to say on your Twitter handle going forward, and who knows what else goes viral, but I do hope that people read what you've already written. Again, we'll post the thread that Miriam wrote about her father and institutional racism on our various platforms. And when you write in the future, we're all going to be listening and reading because we still, and I would say we still, we need this. We still need this. We will need this. And I'm just so glad to know you. I really am. I'm just, you're an amazing woman and you've got, obviously, a remarkable family.
I have a great family and I'm so glad to know you too, Evan. I listen to Connections every day and I learn so much, just like so many of the listeners have said today. I'm always learning from listening to your show.
Now, Miriam's amazing. That's so much that, I think of Sandra in Silver Lake, so much that people might feel like, how come I didn't know this? But if you didn't know this, we're in this together and we're learning, we're listening. Mimsy Way on Twitter, MIMZWAY. Miriam's in. Thank you, Miriam. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. Wherever you are, have a wonderful afternoon, and we will talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.